This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's recent interview with comedian Louis C.K. His FX series, Louis, which is now in its fifth season, is my favorite comedy currently on TV. It's very funny, but it's also taken some surprising emotional and dramatic turns over the years. It's about the daily life of a middle-aged comic named Louis, who, like Louis C.K., is a divorced father of two young girls and is struggling to do right by them and to keep his own life and career together. Louis C.K. has become much more successful and famous since the series began, but that's not true of the version of himself he plays in the series. Louis C.K. also has a new comedy special that's available as a digital download on his website and will air on FX May 28th. And he's going to host the final episode of this season's Saturday Night Live on May 16th. Let's start with a scene from a recent episode of Louis. Louis is at a kitchen cookware store. He wants help with some pricey items, but the young Asian woman who works there hasn't been helpful and just keeps telling him it's closing time. Here he is complaining to her at the checkout counter.
So you just don't care about your customers?
And that whole customer is always right approach is kind of old school.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay then. Then noted. Thank you very much. In the future, I will take my business elsewhere.
Please do. Please go to Williams-Sonoma. They'll be very indulgent.
Wow. Wow, that's a new approach. So you have nothing to learn from thousands of years of human commerce. Just nothing. I really hope that works out for you.
Well, I'm 24 and I own my own store in Manhattan.
All right, then. All right. I will alert my entire generation that your generation needs nothing from us. We will just be on our way.
Well, if you could help clean up the environment you ruined on your way out.
Oh, is there anything else we can get for you, your majesties?
Do you always get uncomfortable around younger people?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why.
I think I maybe know why.
Okay.
Because we're the future. You don't belong in it. Because we're beyond you, and naturally that makes you feel kind of bad. You have this deep down feeling that you don't matter anymore.
Yeah, that's pretty true, yeah.
That's a scene from Louis C.K.'s series Louis. It's a scene from this current season, which is season 5. Louis C.K., welcome back to Fresh Air. It's so great to have you back on the show.
Very glad to be back. Yeah, I still listen to this show more than anything else.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
Love it.
Yeah. That makes me happy. Yeah. What were you working out about age in your mind when you wrote the scene that we just heard?
Well, it's an interesting thing. You know, you when you get older and you become less in the center of things, which I think is part of getting older, you know, there's more energy and focus on younger people. You start to resent it at first. You start to feel like, you know, somebody's taking something away from you. But then you realize that there's a privilege in that and that it means that we're all developing. And it's part of your responsibility as a human, I think, is to, you know, get old and die, get out of the way so things can get better.
Yes, get old and die and get out of the way.
Yeah, exactly. So it's an interesting thing to confront people who are younger than you who aren't children. You know, once you get to your 40s, you start to confront younger adults. And because they have so much pure, nice, sugary, smart blood in their veins, they are very convinced that they really know everything that's going on. You know what I mean? So, but since you've already been them and now you're you, you feel like, well, I just know twice as much as you. But it's just not true.
Who are you? They know, who are you when you were them? Like, what did you think you know that the people older than you did not, which made you smarter than them?
I didn't think. I thought I wasn't. I thought I didn't know. I thought that older people knew more than me. I did. I really did. I didn't have that feeling like I know everything and old people are stupid. But the thing is that they do know more in a way because they know new things. They know new things that we didn't know yet. So because as a collective, the human race is getting smarter, you hope anyway.
So I realized one of the things that what comics can do like you that most of us can't is take things that have happened in your life including bad or embarrassing things, and make them funny in such a way that we, the audience, not only laugh, but we go, oh, yeah, that happened to me, or that nearly happened to me. And then there's the kind of comic who gets on stage, and you just kind of feel sorry for them because they're just not good enough at it, which leads me to the next scene I want to play from your series, Louis. In one of the episodes, you're asked, you know, you've done your act at the comedy club where you perform in the series, and then you're asked at the last minute to host the open mic night part. Mm-hmm. And you really don't want to do it, but you negotiate a deal for a few $100, so you're willing to do it. You have to introduce yourself from the backstage mic because there's no one else to do it. That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
But anyways, before the actual open mic night starts, one of the very young comics comes up to you and says, can you listen and then give me a critique? And you really don't want to do that. And then the guy goes on stage and he talks in this very monotone way, totally without affect, about when he was a child, he used to wet his bed and his mother beat him. And there's absolutely nothing funny in how he tells the story. It's just totally sad. He comes off stage, and then he asks you for a critique. You very reluctantly take him to a coffee shop, and here's the conversation that you have.
So, I don't know what to tell you, Bart.
I'm not funny?
Well, it's tough, but no, you're not. You're not funny. I mean, not on stage, anyway.
Okay, well, what do I change? Is it my jokes or...
Jokes? See, that's the thing. I don't really know that those were really jokes. Like, when you talked about winning a bet on stage, did you think that would be funny?
Well, in comedy, you're supposed to tell the truth, right? You know, just be, like, honest about stuff.
Yeah, but... You have to start with what makes you laugh.
What makes me laugh?
Yeah, you. What makes you laugh? That's where you start. When you think about what to talk about on stage, you start there. What's funny to you?
Buster Keaton, Lucille Ball.
Okay. Okay, listen. You can't do this. It's comedy. You can't do it, Bart. I'm sorry, and You're a nice kid, and I appreciate that you're so earnest. I really do, but... And I would never normally say this, because it's not my right, but I like you, so I gotta tell you, you're not gonna be a comedian. I mean it, never. And you gotta get out. You gotta save yourself some pain.
I can't quit. Never. I'll die first. I love comedy. Is there anything you can tell me that'll make me better? Anything.
Talk in a funny voice, maybe.
That's a scene from Louis C.K.'s FX comedy series, Louis, which is in the middle of its fifth season. Does this happen to you a lot, where younger comics ask you for advice and hope that you'll be their mentor?
Yeah, once in a while, but I'm a lot meaner than that in real life.
Seriously?
No, I gotta go, and I just walk away from them. But now, once in a while, I don't know, I actually sometimes will be proactively, when I see a comedian who shows promise, that's very exciting to me. I love comedy. So when somebody young has a spark to them, I'll often come up to them and just spray out some things I think might be useful to them. People that start doing stand-up are very crazy. You know, they really want it so badly. It's a very deep desire. And when you start, you stink. There's no other way to do it. It takes some kind of mental illness to push against that, you know, to go on stage and just bomb horribly and then still do it because you love it. You just have some really deep desire to make it work. And actually, it's usually the comedians that start awkwardly and badly who end up being interesting. The guys who, from my experience, when I've seen people show up and from the first day on stage, they're just easy, you know, like really amiable comics who just know how to talk to people. They don't usually end up being that special. They get some quick success, but they don't usually turn into something like really unusual and great.
Do you remember your first open mic night? Was that how you started?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'll never forget that.
Can you tell us
horrible.
About it?
Well, I got this. I found out that you could do there was an open mic night at a club in Boston where I started called Stitches. And I was actually like 17, almost 18 years old. And I thought, geez, you can go on stage. They said you do 5 minutes. You just put your name in a hat and you get on stage. You can be anybody. That was so exciting to me. So I went to this club, Stitches, which is very grown up. They didn't even want to let me in because I was underaged. And they have a drinking, you know, a liquor license. And then I went on stage and I did about 2 minutes because I didn't have enough material. Like I just ran, I sputtered, my whole throat constricted, and I heard this roaring in my ears. My eyes were watering. My heart was pounding and I couldn't control myself. I couldn't think straight. And all these adults, like drinking adults, were looking at me like I'm an idiot. And I just walked off stage to kind of confused, like, little applause. And I just felt like a pile of garbage. Then I kept doing it.
When did you start talking about yourself, being self-reflective, as you described it?
I don't know. Once I was in my 20s, you know, I had grown up so much on the road because I started doing stand-up so young. I didn't go to college. So my formative years were being on the road, which meant I had a lot of embarrassing sexual stories because I didn't have a girlfriend all those years because I was on the road. I was traveling everywhere. And also I was doing a very unusual thing. I was doing stand-up when most people my age were in college. You know, so I started telling stories that were like confessional about strange sexual situations I'd been in. I think that's when I started to enjoy confessing and putting myself out there. But then I think it's when I was married and had children that I started to really talk about my own life and what my life felt like.
But before you realized how being a father would give you material for your comedy, did you think, okay, I'm going to be a father and now it's over for me? No more independence, no more easy life on the road, the door slamming shot.
Well, there's always a give and take. I was glad to let go of some of that. The road really sucks when it's all you have. It's really sad. It's very lonely out there. So I was happy to be in a family and be married and everything. And, you know, when I first got married and had kids, I thought, you know, I had some friends I played poker with on Mondays. And I thought the poker game on Mondays is that's the water line. Like if I don't make that game, I'm losing something. I'm losing something if I don't make it to that game. It means I'm letting go of my youth. I'm letting go of my manhood, all these things, my independence. But then after a while, I realized, why would I want to go play poker with a bunch of guys in a smoky room when I could be at home with my family? And I realized that a lot of the things that my kid was taking away from me, she was freeing me of. A lot of things that men hang on to when they're younger, they're not good for you. And that there was this huge pride in having a kid and also that I didn't matter anymore. The greatest thing about having a child is putting yourself second in your own life. It's a massive gift to be able to say that you're not the most important person to yourself.
Why is
it's
that a good probably thing?
Because that's always going to let you down. You know what I mean? The idea of I've got to get me right. I've got to get what I want. That's got to be right. That's never going to quite work. You know, life just isn't that satisfying. But if you can be useful to somebody else, that you can actually accomplish. You know what I mean? You can go, I did a pretty damn good job today as a dad. Pretty good. Best as I could. That's worth so much more.
Last season, in season 4 of Louis, there was a 2-episode season that was largely a series of flashbacks to when your character was in high school and started smoking a lot of marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And started just kind of disconnecting emotionally from people. So he wants to start buying himself. So he goes to like the neighborhood dealer, who's played by Jeremy Renner. And the dealer's kind of like colorful and in his own tough way, almost big brotherish. And to get more money, Louis starts stealing because the dealer needs scales to weigh the marijuana. He convinces Louis to steal scales from the science lab at school. And Louis does that in spite of the fact that he's actually stealing these scales from his best teacher's lab. Mm-hmm. And when he's discovered, he wants to go back and to the dealer and get the scales back. So this is the scene where he goes to the dealer, played by Jeremy Renner, and asks for the scales back.
What can I do you for?
I need to get the scales back.
What?
Can I get them back?
You want... you want me to get the 10 scales from the drug dealers I sold them to?
I'll find a way to pay you back. I just need to return them.
How are you going to pay me back? You still got that weed I gave you?
I smoked it.
You smoked it? All of it?
Well, I shared it, but I...
You shared it?
I don't know.
Well, that's nice of you. But now you got nothing. Hmm. Not so smart after all, are you? Louis. I gotta help you now, right? I'll help you out. I gotta help you out. Come here. Come here. Just breathe, you okay? You're all right. You're all right, aren't you? You're all right. You listening to me? You listening? You scared? Okay, because a second ago you weren't scared. You're scared now. Yeah. What do you think? Huh? Because you're a kid, I ain't gonna hurt you. You think this is games? No. This is man right here. You understand that? You're not a kid, you're a man now. You stole property,
Louis.
A lot of property. What is it, 10 scales? That's like $2,000, isn't it? That's larceny. That is some sick. I never did nothing like that.
So that was Devin Druid as the young Louis C.K. and Jeremy Renner as the dealer. Did you get into trouble when you were in high school because you started smoking marijuana? Is this a fairly autobiographical?
Yes, it is. It's pretty much exactly. Well, not exactly. There's a bunch of differences. This all happened when I was in junior high school. I was in ninth grade when I started to smoke pot and get high and drop acid and snort speed and all kinds of stuff. Yeah, it was really intense. It was a lot of drugs. And I dropped like LSD every weekend. It was crazy. And my mother, my poor mom, my single mom, single working mother of four, didn't know where I was half the time. I would just disappear. And I was barely cognizant of any kind of life. I never went to classes. And I stole triple beam balanced scales from my science teacher, who I really liked, and sold them to a drug dealer. The difference is the Jeremy Renner character, the first time I meet him in the show, is closer to the truth. He was a nice guy. He was just made me feel grown up and treated me like a grown up and made a square deal with me. The part where he gets scary didn't happen to me. I didn't get scared by the thing that I think it's important to know if you have kids, especially teenagers, is that the people they meet that are going to offer them drugs are not bad people. They're really cool people. If somebody – the fiction that you tell kids that people that offer you drugs are evil is not a good fiction to tell them because they're going to be cool people who like them. And that's why drugs are so easy to fall into as a kid. And right away you know, well, my parents are liars because this person is cool. This person understands me better than they do. That's part of why people do drugs, is because they're making a connection with people that they really feel as strongly about. And also it's their first connection that they choose is their teenage connections.
What do you get?
But anyway,
what do you get out of LSD when you're in eighth grade? I mean, you're too young for the kind of mind-altering experience where there's some kind of new transcendental understanding of your place in the world and you're seeing things with a new perspective and you realize things about the world that you didn't. That's like not going to happen to you in eighth grade. So
how much acid did you do, Terry? when you were.
But so what is the eighth grade experience of an LSD trip?
Well, I don't know. I think that the one you're describing is I'm not sure whoever got that. I guess they did that back in the 60s. They had those feelings when they dropped acid. I don't know. It's just a really strong drug. I didn't have anything, any epiphany. I had some bad trips. Me and my friends took acid and went to a Grateful Dead concert at Boston Garden. And it was a pretty amazing feeling. And back then, you know, Jerry Garcia was alive and well, and I'm in Boston Garden and Jerry Garcia singing Grateful Dead songs, and I'm on acid, and how old are you in eighth grade? I was 13 years old.
13 sounds right, yeah. Yeah.
And I was at a Grateful Dead concert on acid and surrounded by people of all ages and types that are wasted, all tripping. And Jerry Garcia was probably tripping and on heroin or whatever. And it was I went over this hill of like excitement and euphoria and like feeling this rush of like there's like caramel, like the air smelled like caramel and I felt like I was breathing it. It was this amazing feeling. But then I went over that hill into this horrible, it totally changed to a building packed with predator, strange people who I didn't know what they were thinking, and I didn't like Jerry anymore. And I turned to my friend and I said, I have to get out of here. I'm freaking out. And my friend didn't want to leave. He was having a good time. So now he's mad at me. And that's one of the most terrifying things that I've ever experienced.
Did you leave?
At the Dead show. Yes, I left. And then I was walking the streets of Boston trying to get home. And it was freezing cold out. And the whole world was a nasty, hostile place. And it was going right to the – I had no comfort. You know, like you kind of imagine your skull and your hair is like a little bit of a shield against the rest of the world. You have your own mind. It was like the cold outside was getting right to the center of my brain. It was a horrible feeling.
And then you did it again? You took it again after that?
Yeah, I suppose I did it again. I don't know how many more times I did it after that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I knew kids who dropped acid when we were in junior high school who didn't come back from it, who got, you know, mm-hmm. who got real quiet mm-hmm. and weird after one time.
When you decided to change your life and to stop doing drugs or at least do less of them and to mm-hmm. start emotionally connecting better to your family, look, what were the changes that you made?
Well, stopping the drugs was the first one, and I went about it in a way that probably wasn't good for me, which is I just stopped. You know, I kind of envy people that went through. It never occurred to me to go to like a 12-step program. I just stopped. So I got pretty depressed. Like if you use drugs as a kid and then all of a sudden you have no drugs and you took 2 years off of building your emotional support for yourself, all of a sudden you got nothing. So I got real down. But I started paying attention to school more. I started being fascinated by what I was learning in school. And I had a teacher in high school who got me an internship at a cable TV station in Newton, Mass. They had a cable, local access cable station. And I started learning about shooting video. I shot the high school football games and the hockey games. Like I became like the whiz kid at the local access cable TV station. And also my mom is a great, great person. So after I came out of that horrible cloud that caused so much trouble for her of drugs and stuff, she was there as my friend. She was there to talk, as somebody to talk to.
Louis C.K.'s latest comedy special is now available as a download on his website. He's scheduled to host the season finale of Saturday Night Live on May 16th. And if you want to hear a longer version of Louis C.K.'s conversation with Terry, you'll find it on our podcast at itunes.com/freshair. The Norwegian writer Carl Uwe Knausgård has won comparisons to Marcel Proust for his long autobiographical novel My Struggle. This 6-volume series is being published in English translation by Archipelago Books, which, beginning in 2012, has been releasing 1 volume a year. Book 4 has just come out. Our critic at large, John Powers, has read the 1,915 pages of My Struggle published so far and says you shouldn't let its length scare you off.
It seems like there's always some writer you're supposed to be reading. These days, it's Karl Ove Knausgård, the 46-year-old Norwegian whose six-volume, 3,600-page autobiographical novel, My Struggle, has become a literary sensation. Over the last couple of years, I haven't been able to go to a social gathering without someone asking what I thought of his work. When I've said that I hadn't read a word, they would look genuinely startled and tell me, "You have to." Well, I finally gave in a few weeks ago and was abashed to discover that one of Knausgård's trademark themes is his disdain for the sheep-like souls who do exactly what everyone else is doing. Oh, well. Still, I'm happy that I succumbed. You see, My Struggle, which is heroically well translated by Don Bartlett, is surely the grand monument to our selfie-absorbed times. In its ambition, narcissism, and exhausting exhaustiveness, the book feels like the culmination of our current obsession with the memoir. Now, one feels a tad silly talking about My Struggle in a short review. I have one word for every 27 pages I've read. But luckily, Knausgård's project isn't arcane. He tells you the story of his life, from his boyhood on a small Norwegian island to his current existence as a writer and married father of four living in Sweden. He gives us his fear and hatred of his domineering father, his feeling of being an unmanly outsider in high school, his love for and battles with his Swedish wife Linda, and much, much, much more. What makes his book extraordinary is not what happens, which couldn't be more familiar or ordinary. It's that Knausgård aims to capture the unending blizzard of feelings, objects, people, and situations that make up a life. At the same time, like Proust, the inevitable point of comparison, he hopes to shape all this stuff into a form that gives his experience a larger meaning. To that end, he plays hopscotch with time, place, and mood. Volume 1 begins with a highfalutin riff on death, moves into a 100-page account of underage Carl and a pal sneaking beer for New Year's Eve, and builds to the burial of his father in one of the unforgettable sequences in contemporary literature. In contrast, the comparatively lighthearted Volume 4 is filled with boozing and sexual embarrassment. No writer has ever admitted to quite so many premature ejaculations. Knausgård's confident directness has won him raves from scads of star writers who clearly see new possibilities for their own writing in his books. They especially admire the ways he's not like them. He's earnest, not cute, bouncy, or ironic. He's not afraid to use clichés and doesn't polish every sentence like a new Lamborghini. Unlike most novelists who feel they must compete with video games and Game of Thrones, he doesn't kill himself trying to make every moment exciting. There may be something Oedipal in this. In Volume 3, Knausgård revealingly notes that one of his dad's unbearable qualities was purging any situation of everything that had no direct relevance to what they were doing. If they were going somewhere, Dad drove there grimly fast. If they ate, it was only because food is necessary. Knausgård's own vision of life is almost the opposite. I've never read a good novelist who deliberately included so many things that serve no evident point. For him, such unfiltered inclusiveness does justice to the cluttered density of experience, and it gives his work a strong hypnotic pull. In calling his book My Struggle, Knausgård daringly echoes Hitler's Mein Kampf, which I'm told he talks about at length in Volume 6. But he's not being flip with this title the way an American writer would be. The book actually is about his struggle, with his father, with death, with his muse, with his feelings of inadequacy, with the dreariness of a daily life that offers teasing glimpses of transcendence. If this sounds a bit grandiose, it is. Yet Knausgård is not a difficult writer, like Proust, Joyce, or David Foster Wallace. He's pointedly unliterary. Anyone can understand what he's writing. And paradoxically enough, his honest, obsessive self-absorption makes his life feel universal. As I was reading, every single subject that came up in my daily living, parents, politics, education, Italian food, trees, even David Byrne, reminded me of something in Knausgård. His work makes you realize that each and every one of our lives contains rich enough material for a long, daunting book called My Struggle.
John Powers writes about film and television for Vogue. He reviewed the four volumes published in English of My Struggle by Karl Ove Knausgård. The music of singer-songwriter Pokey Lafarge is influenced by blues and country recordings of the 20s, 30s, and 40s. It's been featured on the soundtrack of HBO's Prohibition-era series Boardwalk Empire. And the fans of his music include Jack White, who produced a Pokey Lafarge recording and invited Pokey to open for him on a 2013 tour. Pokey Lafarge is currently on tour in support of his seventh album. It's called Something in the Water. On a recent stop in Nashville, Lafarge went to a studio to record an interview with Terry Gross. He also brought his guitar so he could perform a few songs. Before we hear that recording, let's hear Pokey Lafarge with his band on the new album. This is an example of one of his songs that's rooted in the Midwest, where Lafarge's family has lived for generations. It's called Knocking the Dust Off the Rust Belt Tonight.
Lights are on, it's time to go. Gotta hit stage for another show. Knocking the dust off the rust belt tonight. I started out all by myself, but I'm lucky now that I found some help. Knock the dust off the rust belt tonight. Have you seen what's happening around here? You ask most people, they don't care. But now is the time, we have to do things right. So we're knocking the dust off the rust belt tonight. From the CHI to the STL, I was born to raise a ruckus and do it well.
That's Pokey Lafarge from his new album, Something in the Water. Pokey, welcome to Fresh Air. It is such a pleasure to have you, and thank you so much for bringing your guitar with you. So your music is so influenced by music of the 20s and 30s. How were you first exposed to that?
Well, it was sort of coming to a fork in the road, and like Yogi Berra says, when you see a fork in the road, take it. I just kept following the signs. I certainly was being exposed to a lot of the same music that any kid would be exposed to at the time there in grade school, junior high, respectively.
And what was that for you? What were the hits
same
of the
old,
time?
Yeah, I mean, this is like mid-90s, so, you know, like Snoop Dogg and Ice Cube and all different kinds of stuff. And I love that stuff, but as I started to really get interested in my own creativity, and I got to hear some early blues around 13, you know, the real old blues and the acoustic stuff, just a guy and a guitar, you know, seemingly crying with his guitar and the voice and the guitar becoming one. That was the real big, that was the sign. Okay, yeah, this is real music. And so then, phew, from there, in all different directions.
Can you play a few bars of a song like that, an early blues song that really got you going?
I'd love to. This is a song by a guy from Indianapolis named Leroy Carr. This is called In the Evening.
In the evening, babe, when the sun go down. Late in the evening, mama, yes, when the sun go down. Lonesome, it's so lonesome when your love's not around, when the sun goes down.
That's great. You've got this kind of trill in your voice sometimes that I really like a lot, and very few people sing that way anymore. And I was wondering if that was something you had to work on, or if you found that you naturally had that in your voice?
Well, you know, there's a way that in traditional jazz, in New Orleans jazz, with clarinetists, they would have to have this, they came up with this really whiny, you know, tremolo, vibrato type style.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
and,
like
Sidney Bechet. Yeah, I was like my favorite soloist of all time. I cry when I hear his playing, sort of like Sean Penn's character in Sweet and Low Down, you know, when he hears Django Reinhardt.
Yeah, yeah.
But they had to come up with this vibrato to compensate for the poor quality of the clarinet, you know, just like literally warping in the humidity there in New Orleans. And I think, I don't know, maybe it's the same thing with my voice. I'm compensating for notes that I can't hit cleanly. I'm certainly not a trained singer. I'm just kind of following a feeling.
Oh, I don't see it. I don't hear it as compensatory. I hear it as as being in keeping with the period that inspired you, when I think a lot of singers had that kind of vibrato or tremolo. Or almost true.
Maybe so,
yeah.
But you know, there's been some great singers even throughout, I mean, throughout the rock and roll era and into now, that are singing that way. I mean, even Tom Jones or like Morrissey, you know, they throw in this really cool vibrato. They just do it a little tighter, almost more like a more classical type way. Yeah, I guess maybe you're saying there's more of a difference, but. I don't know. Vibrato is certainly a thing. Maybe you're saying the trill is more specific, and I think there is definitely a big part of that, an influence from old singers for sure.
So you're a fan of Tom Jones? You're like Delilah?
Yeah. I love that song. Are you
me
kidding
too.
Me? If that tune comes on, I'll definitely
it's
be
so big.
Fist pumping.
So desperate.
I'm a sucker for epic yeah. pieces like
Do
that.
Do you sing songs like that? I can't. You know, it's like hard for me imagining you doing that.
I mean, I could play a tune that's sort of epic. I mean, if you listen to it on the record, it's more epic. But I could play a little bit of a tune that I wrote that's kind of epic.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go. Yeah.
Last night I dreamed you were a glass of Rioja wine we drank on the first night we met. You had crossed my tongue, traced through my veins. You could have gone with me in the morning I left. Oh, La Miva, Marca, Senorita, you danced the sardana bare feet on the floor. When you get tired, lay your head on my chest. Please hear my song, don't you cry anymore. Oh, my heart is a bird that sings while you're gone. La da 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 da. The loneliest song that you've ever heard. La da 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 da. Goodbye, Barcelona. So glad I've been shown you. I'm going, I'm leaving the land of the sun. The far north where I don't wanna go, where the rain it stops for no one. Yes, but I'm bringing a bottle of rum. Woo, woo.
Really nice. And that's a song called Goodbye Barcelona that Pokey Lafarge wrote, and it's featured on his new album, which is called Pokey Lafarge Something in the Water, and that's Pokey playing in the studio for us. That sounded terrific. Really nice song.
Thank you.
I'd like you to do another song for us, and this is a song that you wrote and you perform on your new album, Something in the Water. It's called I Want to Be Your Man. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about writing this?
Well, Want to Be Your Man is one of those tunes where you just kind of write it and it happens, boom, it's done. You know, other songs you write bits and pieces of and you're kind of wondering where the song can go, wondering where the hook is at. But with this one, you know, in respect to even the first verse, something's wrong, honey, this I know, never seen you this way before, hey, baby, I want to be your man. And even right then, I was like, want to be your man, that's the hook. So just wrote it from there, and even automatically the tempo, zoom, chant, boom, chant, boom, chant, boom. Just like that. And I was like, man, that would sound real good with a tuba. And if you listen to the record, you'll hear it with a tuba. And first song I've ever recorded with a tuba, it just worked out. So let's see if we can do this here. Want to be your man. Something's wrong, honey, this I know. I never seen you this way before. Hey, baby, I wanna be your man. I can tell you need a friend. Step aside, won't you let me in? Hey, baby, who do you think I am? Woo, this late and it's about to pour. Your neighbor's tired of me hanging around your door. I say one thing and nothing more. I wanna be your man. Wanna be your man. Wanna be your man. Wanna be your man. There's a little taste there.
Yeah, I like that. And I like it with the tuba too. I like it with the full band. In fact, let's hear a chorus of the song with your whole band from your new album, Something in the Water.
Something's wrong, honey, this I know. Never seen you this way before. Hey, baby, I wanna be your man. I can tell you need a friend. Step aside, won't you let me in? Hey, baby, who do you think I am? It's late and it's about to pour. Your neighbor's tired of me hanging around your door. I say one thing and nothing more. I
wanna be your man.
Some people don't like me hanging around. But there's no reason for it that I found. Hey, baby, please don't look so sad. When you're all alone and you need a hand, let me come into your house and be a handyman. Hey, baby, what about the fun we've had? It's late and it's about to pour. Your neighbor's tired of me hanging around your door. Say one thing and nothing more. I
wanna be your man.
That's Pokey Lafarge from his new album, Something in the Water. Tell us a little bit about your upbringing and your family and your neighborhood.
Well, you know, I moved around a lot before I graduated high school. I'd actually say that probably has something to do with why I'm comfortable with traveling so much even now, and maybe even why I had no problem leaving everything behind. Grew up playing baseball. That was my thing, baseball. I wanted to be a professional baseball player. That didn't work out. I think my dad even told me, he's like, you're not going to be a professional baseball player. And I remember being really mad at him for saying that. But I'm glad he told me that. It was pretty real.
Well, did he also tell you you weren't going to be a professional musician?
He didn't tell me that. I think he just kind of was trying to steer me away from that. But yeah, he's my biggest supporter. My whole family, my mom, you know, stepmom, grandparents, they're all, yeah, biggest supporters now.
Did you have to learn how to be uninhibited on stage?
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah, especially since I had no... I mean, I was always sort of a ham. I talk a lot, I'm loud. I was always performing growing up, but not on stage. Nothing has come easy for me. It's taken a lot of hard work, a lot of experimentation, a lot of kind of looking inside yourself and saying, hey, man, you know, man up. You know, you got to leave it all on stage. And I think I finally got to the point where I am confident to just leave it all on stage, like I have nothing to lose. And it's been good. I think we're actually playing the best shows that we've ever played now, finally.
So there's something else about your performing style I want to ask about, and that is that you whistle.
Yeah, a little bit, you know.
It's kind of a lost art. There's some great recordings from the 1920s with this great warbling whistling on it.
So good.
Yeah. Do you want to do a song with some whistling in it?
Oh, gosh. Okay. Let's see what I can do. Do they miss you? Let's see. Do they miss you? Can you get back in? What if I kissed you? Would you tell me if it would be? Would it be a little sin? No.
I'm only human, baby, but you are so divine. I wanna know, when did you leave heaven? Oh, little angel of mine.
Oh, nice. Thank you for that. That's Pokey Lafarge, and that's actually a song that he also does on his new album, which is called Something in the Water. And that's an old song, I think, from the 1930s. It's actually from a 1936 movie. And the movie had, like, Tony Martin, Alice Faye, the Ritz Brothers, Patsy Kelly, who was in a lot of Gene Autry movies.
Nice.
And
you
the
know
song,
your stuff, Terry.
Yeah, well, the song was, well, the melody was written by Richard Whiting, who wrote songs
Richard
like
Whiting.
On the Good Ship Lollipop for
on
the Shirley
Good
Temple
Ship
movie.
Lollipop. Boom, you got it.
Yeah, Ain't We Got Fun, Hooray for Hollywood, My Ideal. And it's such a great example of the kind of cross-pollination in American music. Like, how do you know that song? Probably not from the movie.
It was from Big Bill Brunzi.
Okay, and, great. So you know it as a blues song.
Well, yeah, but also there's a great singer. Actually, I first heard it from Thomas Frazier, who's this crazy multi-instrumentalist from the Shetland Islands of Scotland who first heard country music when USO radio was being broadcast and you could pick up the waves over the Atlantic. I recommend anybody checking him out. You want to talk about a yodel and a whistle? This guy is insane. But I'm a sucker for a good melody, a sweet sort of melancholic tune, like I did in Let's Get Lost. And I think I writing songs from that vein, it definitely has roots in the past. But, I mean, you know, you hear that in today's music in different ways, perhaps not so attached to earlier stuff. But, you know, the Beatles are a good representation of that. I think the Beatles really, they could write songs that were sweet and melancholic, but definitely rooted in sort of that Tin Pan Alley and early pop tunes.
Pokey Lafarge speaking with Terry Gross. Lafarge currently is on tour in support of his new album called Something in the Water. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallant, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.